We'll call the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development to order. It's just after 1 o'clock on Wednesday. Thank you all for coming to a non-standard location for us. We have a very busy agenda, so we're going to get right started, and we'll open an informational meeting on transit. We have a panel of three people to start with, Mark Pangorn, Neil McFarlane, and Heather Ornelas. On deck, David Williams, Deborah Daly, Norman Bowen, if you can be in a good spot. These chairs up front here look like a good spot to start. Whoever would like to start, please.
I'm Mark Pangborn, Chairs Benson Reed. Thank you for having us today. I am the president of the Oregon Transit Association, and I'll lead off here. The Oregon Transit Association, also known as OTA, is a nonprofit statewide organization dedicated to improving public transit. Whether Oregonians are directly utilizing transit or not, transit plays a vital role in all our lives. Not only does transit serve essential economic development objectives, but it connects Oregonians with their communities, local businesses, employers, and core public services. Transit also addresses the state's core conservation objectives by significantly reducing traffic congestion and carbon emissions. Today, Oregon's growing population and aging demographics is placing immense budget pressure on Oregon's increasingly cash-strapped transit districts. That problem is exacerbated by the lack of dedicated funding for transit. As a result, Oregon's transit districts must run highly efficient operations, scraping together different sources of funds in order to make their budget ends meet. The only state source of earmarked funds comes from cigarette taxes, which is a declining revenue, as you know, and then a small amount from Department of Motor Vehicles for an ID fund and a little bit of what they call the lawnmower fund. So we're really very, very limited. So this really brings up two critical issues that I know the legislature is dealing with, the Business Energy Tax Credit, or I'll refer to that as BETSI, and the Senior and Disabled Transit Services. We're going to have a number of speakers that will speak specifically to that, but let me kind of sum them up. On the BETSI side, we have the employer classes. That's BETSI provides an employer incentive to participate in transit programs, and my colleague here, Neil McFarlane, will talk about that in the Portland area, but it actually applies in Salem and Eugene as well. Student transit passes. Not all school districts have yellow school buses. As a result, transit is a primary source of options for many students, and in our community with school buses, it also serves many different students with different needs. And then finally, rural transit. Oregon's rural transit districts utilize the BETSI to increase fuel efficiency and deliver services to the rural constituency. The other part of it is senior and disabled transit services. Again, there is no dedicated source of funds beyond a cigarette tax for that. And nationwide, we know we're getting increasing populations of retirees. The estimate is by 2030, 28% of our population will be elderly or persons with disabilities. We are required under the Americans with Disability Act to provide a certain level of services for people who are older adults or with disabilities, and we are finding a terrible funding gap in that. This next year, LTD will be spending $2.5 million out of our general fund money in order to fund that service. This is services that we've really had to take out of our fixed route. So, OTA supports innovative solutions to helping cover this funding gap, including earmarking a portion of the reduction of the senior medical deduction and elderly and disabled transit as a proposed in House Bill 2577 and 2582.
Thank you, Mr. Pangborn. I'm a little concerned about the time,
okay.
So if that's a good spot to
quick,
that'd be great. Mr. McFarlane.
Co-chairs Reed and Benz, we're pleased that you have us here today and for taking a little bit of time to talk about the public transit and how important it is for the state.
We need you to start with your name for the record, please.
I'm sorry. I was going to do that right now. My name is Neil McFarlane. I'm the general manager of TriMet, again, the transit district that serves the greater Portland area. As you know, our region is the 23rd largest in the nation, yet our transit system actually is number 8 per capita in terms of the number of people we carry. That's over 100 million people a year riding transit on trips on TriMet. It's also 1 million people on paratransit, which serves, as my colleague from Lane County noted, persons who are elderly and disabled based on eligibility under the ADA. The good news is, of course, TriMet is a national leader. You know, recently, U.S. News and World Report rated us the number one city for transit in the nation. But the bad news is that we find ourselves in the same position as state government due to the effects of what we call now the Great Recession. TriMet has reduced our budget more than $60 million from its projected levels over the last few years. And we've managed this by a three-year salary freeze and reductions in our health care for our management staff, layoffs and furloughs, and cutting service about 13%, which has been tragic for many people in the region. We are working hard to reduce our health care costs for our union employees, and that continues to be an area of energy on my part. As my colleague from Eugene noted, the business energy tax credit represents great value to transit riders, and we think to the state it is a recognized area of conservation that actually provides conserves fuel, helps provide additional service. It has great leverage, removes single occupancy vehicles from our roads, and reduces pollution. So we think it's an important objective of the state to continue that business energy tax credit. In sum, I just wanted to say again that leave you with this one thought, that our citizens are demanding more and more of our transit systems and more from our transportation choices. One statistic is that we have an aging population, again, needing more transit services. 10,000 people turn 65 every day in the U.S., and that will continue for the next 19 years. We have increased gas and diesel prices. We have the needs to get people to new jobs. We have population growth in the metropolitan area of 1 million people over the next 25 years. And so we have a lot of demands to meet, and we can only meet those with the continued help and support of the state. So we appreciate the time that you're spending with us.
Thank you, Ms. McFarland. Ms. Ornelas?
Yes, hello. Thank you. My name is Heather Ornelas, and I'm the Bend Transit Manager, which is now part of the new Cascades East Transit, serving the greater Central Oregon region, a region that I think highlights our emerging transit needs and challenges, both urban and extremely rural. As you know, Central Oregon has been very hard hit by the economic downturn. And in fact, Cook County has the highest at 16.4%. All three counties, over 13% unemployment. But Cascades East Transit has a responsibility to help our local businesses get their employees to work and allow them to keep more of what they make to support their families. Cascades East Transit is also not just the newest system in the state, but the fastest ridership growth. We, in addition to our Bend and regional routes, offer demand response service throughout the region using a patchwork of funding sources. One of those is Betsy, and we use that to match vehicle grants and to use for preventative maintenance. This program allows our seniors in areas like Sisters, Lapine, Prineville, Metolius, and Madras to age in place and have the freedom to get to those essential services. As Betsy programs are restructured, please consider ways to retain its original conservation vision and allow us to have the honor of delivering assistance to our rural Oregonians. We've tried several new ideas to help Central Oregon build. We have our new Hawthorne Station opening just this week. This is an area where all modes can meet right in downtown Bend, taxis, city buses, regional buses, and our private bus lines. We have a partnership with Mount Bachelor. They supplied the local match, and together we went and got a Transit in the Parks grant to basically refurbish and get new buses so that Mount Bachelor could continue to bring its employees and visitors up to the mountain, and we can make this a four-season event. And we also are very proud of services like our Ride the River. Started off for safety, but it has become with the little trailers and buses to help people float through downtown Bend, an actual generator of new business in our area. Now, these are just a couple of examples on how we partner and we stretch our mix of funding to meet our regional needs, whether they be urban or rural, or for commuters, youth, or seniors. We encourage you to support efforts such as House Bill 2577 and 2582 that earmarks a portion of the reduction to the senior medical deduction, or opportunities to continue conservation efforts started by Betsy that help us deliver mobility.
Thank you, Ms. Arnelson.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Appreciate you being here. Next up, David Williams, Deborah Daly, Norman Bowen, and I should have made this clear as we started. We have a really packed agenda, so I'm going to need to limit your comments to 2 minutes each so we can keep on our schedule. So whoever would like to start, I'll give you the I'll cut you off at 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Williams with Portland Public Schools. I can do better than 2 minutes. I do have a hard copy of my testimony coming out to the committee. Just wanted to highlight the unique situation we have in Portland that really leverages alternative financing methods as well as a unique partnership we have with TriMet to provide transportation to our high school age students and really introduce a generation of users to public transportation in Portland. We previously provided TriMet passes to about 3,000 students in the district, high-risk, at-need students, students with transfer eligibility under No Child Left Behind. But thanks to financing in the State Business Energy Tax Credit, we are able to expand that program where we are providing TriMet passes to all 13,000 high school students in the district. This, of course, allows us to not run traditional yellow bus services, bringing kids to and from school. And I will note the uniqueness of this and the benefit is not simply in financial to the district, although that is a great benefit, and it is financially more solvent to the state overall, as 70% of our transportation costs are reimbursed by the state for traditional yellow bus service. But that traditional yellow bus service only provides transportation to and from school. It doesn't provide transportation for kids who take advantage of unique district-wide programs throughout the day, students attending charter schools in the district, or other alternative programs. So we think this is a great program, a great relationship we have with TriMet, and we certainly hope you all will find ways to extend our ability to leverage those resources and those relationships. Thank you.
And a half. Thank you, Mr. Williams. And before you get started, just so people know, on deck, Annette Price, Craig Campbell, Bob Russell. Please go ahead.
My name is Deborah Daly. I am the homeless liaison for the 4J School District. I work for the homeless program. The student pass program is at the core of the success of the student homeless students. This is the way they get to school. Many students, by law, federal law, students that are homeless can remain in their school of origin. That means the school that they were attending when they became homeless. Now, that the next move might take them a mile, 3 miles, 6 miles across district. Having to be able to take the bus back to their school of origin provides school stability. They use the bus for many other things, applying for jobs, medical care, friends, after-school programs. But basically, homeless students use the buses to get to and from school. Now, I know often that I don't know where my students end up sleeping at night, but I do know that they have a pass in their pocket. They have a pass in their pocket or a pass in their backpack. And this, to me, is really their ticket to finishing school, going on with their education, becoming a really great citizen, breaking the cycles of poverty, getting out of abusive families. It's really important. And as I went to some of my schools and I asked for testimony, and over and over and over again, it was, if I don't have this pass, I can't go to school.
Thank you, Ms. Daly. Thank you very much. Mr. Bowen. If you could share the microphone a little bit over there,
right.
Probably helpful. Thank you.
Representative Pence, Representative Reed, and members of the committee. My name is Norman Bowen. I'm a junior at North Eugene Alternative High School. I'm here to testify about the importance of the BETC program that funds free transit for students. I myself am a student, and I rely on that bus every day to get to school and home. I've used that bus to get to job interviews. I've gone to many doctor's appointments, get to get physicals for sports. I've used that bus to help a friend out, to help moving. And sure, it was awkward on the bus, but yes. I'm an avid bus driver. And with all the school budgets that are being cut, my school has to move next year, and if it moves even farther and I don't have a bus pass to get there, I'm not really going to be able to make it.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony, and it's very helpful to hear how it impacts your life on a daily basis. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, can I just say welcome to a hometown school guy?
Absolutely. Thank you very much for being here. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Probably for David, have we thought about other ways to fund this other than through the BETC or sort of renamed or restructured BETC? That's one of the key questions we're supposed to be asking. There's a proposal on the film tax credit, for instance, that we didn't end up doing, might or might not have been a good idea. There's an idea on affordable housing tax credits. Hey, how about we help fund a program that helps the renters, not just the builders? Is there any other way we could imagine funding this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think if there were readily available alternative funding streams for this type of program, I think we would have done them. As I mentioned, we have traditionally been providing transit passes to eligible students, which was about 3,000 high school kids, and only through leveraging the mechanism of the Betsy were we able to expand that to an additional 10,000 students, so all 13,000 high school students. And it's not without concerted effort on the part of our transportation department to try to figure out alternative ways of providing transit to kids to and from school and other programs. So I don't have one off the top of my head, and I can certainly assure you that our transportation department is working feverishly with the city and TriMet to come up with a plan B should other should this body have other another avenue for the Betsy program. But I think it is certainly the plan A and the best opportunity for us to be able to provide this type of opportunity for kids.
Thanks.
Glad to hear you. Working on a plan B. We'll be interested in seeing plan C, D, and E as well. next up, Annette Price, Craig Campbell, Bob Russell. And on deck, Shayla Hansen, Arlette Janice, and Eric Stanchion, please.
I'll go first. Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Annette Price. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, but testifying to you today in my capacity as the President of the Oregon Transportation Forum. And it's in that role that my comments are directed. The Oregon Transportation Forum used to be known as the Oregon Highway Users Alliance for over 20 years. And we are working as we have moved clearly into the 21st century to ensure that we are looking at transportation in a multimodal aspect. It's not just about highways and roads anymore. And these gentlemen to my right will describe some of that in their comments. But I want to talk to you today about specifically transit. We believe transit plays a huge role as we continue into the future of transportation and look forward to finding ways to work with you and this committee in future funding mechanisms that may benefit multimodal transportation. We were successful, as you know, in the 2009 session in getting a highway transportation package passed this body, and in the future, it's not just about roads. It's about it all. And in my role at the Port of Portland, we have trains, planes, and ships. We have to work towards a more comprehensive solution in the future. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Price. Mr. Campbell.
Chair Reed, Chair Benz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA. AAA's interest in transit is really twofold. The first is that as we have been looking at the state's goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and as transportation accounts for about 40% of that, we need to have a variety of tools that are at the table that are available for us to accomplish that goal. For our members, the ability when they step out of their door to make a decision about how they get to work, or they get to the store, or they get to the doctor's office, really we want to have as many options available to them as possible. Now, maybe that they choose to get in their car and go there, but we also want to make sure that to the extent that they wish to avail themselves of transit services, that those transit services are present and they're easily available. The second benefit of transit services is that they reduce congestion on our roads that allow my members to get to those other places as quickly as possible if they choose to avail themselves of either transit or their automobiles. The one thing I should mention that for not only in the long-term question of how do we fund transit, but also how we make our system work better, is that we need to have a much more integrated process for determining where transit goes, how it integrates with the existing system, so that those systems are complementing each other. And with that, I'll go ahead and pass the microphone over to my compatriot to the right. Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Associations, and my members certainly recognize that we need a strong multimodal transportation system for the movement of not only goods but also for people if we're going to meet Oregon's transportation challenges for the future. Transit is very much a part of that equation, and to the extent that it helps Craig's members keep their cars at home to make more room for my members on the highways, we appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your efficiency. Our last panel, Shayla Hansen, Arlette Janice, Eric Stanchion, please. We can get that chair out of the way. Thanks very much.
Whoops.
Hi, I'm Shayla Hershon. Actually, they got my name wrong. Right. I'm here partly to introduce these two lovely young women. One is my daughter, who will introduce herself, and my daughter's friend, who want to tell you a little bit about how the public transportation system has enhanced their life as people with disabilities, allowed them to become independent. And then I'm going to just say a few words on behalf of the carless, of which I am one.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Eleanor Bailey. I really think that when your child with a disability grows up, it goes to CTC, public schools. How are they going to learn to take the bus when they don't know how to take it? I'm saying that it's important to keep the bus system and keep what you guys are doing is great. I want you to keep it the way it is.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Cristal Figueroa, and I'm here to talk about behalf on the TriMet system. I've been taking TriMet ever since I was 15 years old, when I was in 8th grade. It was really a pleasure to take the buses, and it's really fun, and it's also a way to learn how to take the buses around the world, the way you are right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just want to add a little bit. Sorry I didn't get a chair here, but we'll make do. I don't want to go into my whole history. I returned from Central America when Cristal was 6 in order for her to take advantage of the special education system. At that time, I was a single mom, entered the workforce, and because I'm bilingual and have some skills, I quickly got a job, but I did the math. So I was making $1,500, took home $1,200, rent was $475, the babysitter was $250. Utilities were about another $150. Do it yourself. And I had about $450 left over that I could go into debt with and buy a car with, or I could spend it on food. So I chose not to go into debt, did not use a car. And to this day, our situation has improved, but I prefer to use TriMet because it allows us to live a fairly comfortable life. That's a big chunk of money. Most people can't afford it, but they have one anyway because they're not lucky enough. My daughter has been on the buses with me since she was about 6, and it was easy for her to make the transition through RideWise. However, I just want to say how important it is. If you take the bus with me any morning up to Park Rose, Line 71, you will meet so many people for whom that is a lifeline. People who have been unemployed and have their first job have had to give up a car, people looking for work, so many stories, mothers taking their little kids to Head Start in the morning, dropping them off and going to work on another bus. It kept me off public assistance. It probably saved Portland Public Schools several hundred dollars on their transportation because Cristal was able to be independent on the buses. It's just such a vital part of our public our safety net. And I just want to say very much thank you for using your legs and your brains to figure out where to get the money to keep it going.
Thanks very much. We appreciate
it. And good luck.
Thank you. We will need it. We appreciate you being here very much.
Hi. My name is Arlette Janice. And I became part of the transit here 4 years ago. I was having a surgery, and it went terribly wrong. And all of a sudden, I was in a nursing home, flat on my back, bedridden for over a year. And my daughters took me out and brought me home and said, "We're going to get you back." And that brought me to a phone call to RideWise. My daughter had a little baby, and we had to figure things out. Through RideWise, they first put me in with an organization that picked me up, brought me to therapy 3 times a week, got me going. And I think more than being disabled and in this chair, the depression is the worst. But being able to get out and get my therapy, I became stronger. And I was up for like 1 hour to 2 hours a day in my chair. I started adding. Each time I kept going, adding an hour or 15 minutes, being longer. Then they told me how to do the TriMet lift system, which I was stronger and able to do and get more therapy and get out and be independent, not have to be there for rides here, ask my daughter, just to be normal again. The biggest problem with losing my legs is not my legs, it's jumping in my car and going somewhere. That was the hardest thing. But from there, TriMet brought somebody into my home, a trainee, and showed me how to ride the bus. I'd never been on a bus before in my life. They showed me, they brought me down to a transit station and showed me how to get on and off buses. They taught me, told me how to do routes. Now I actually get on bus by myself. I get a little confused sometimes, but the drivers are great. I get to therapy. I'm up for 6 to 7 hours a day, and I'm almost ready to live on my own. So please keep this for other people going through what I had to, because it saved my life.
Thank you very much. It's terrific to hear your story. Congratulations on your success.
You.
Keep it up.
Chair Reed, Chair Benz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Stash, and I'm the communications director for 1000 Friends of Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to testify before the committee. I'll be even briefer than I already was going to be. A lot of people think of 1000 Friends of Oregon as a land use organization, so why are we here testifying on transit? Well, it's because really what we are is an organization that supports building livable urban and rural communities, and that livability includes the integration of land use and transportation, and that's really a key to provide communities where residents aren't dependent on the car, where people have transportation options to either walk, bike, or take transit. Transit's obviously a very crucial piece of that livability. And I could go through the numerous policy benefits, cost savings, reduction of greenhouse gases, et cetera. You've heard some of that before. I just want to say none of those policy benefits, as important as they are more meaningful than the personal stories that you've heard. And so I just want to say that we have a challenge in this state. Certainly you have a challenge in filling a huge budget hole. I don't envy that challenge for you. But financing, providing long-term stable financing for our transit systems is something that is really a policy challenge that I think the legislature needs to weigh in on. And we'd be happy for providing any assistance we can with you on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stash. And we obviously have a lot to deal with today. Did you have a question, Representative Smith? Very quickly.
And Eric, if feel free to offer an answer later. I'm wondering if there's any federal funds available for this sort of thing, if it's unprecedented or precedented for there to be federal funds to help support local transit. Again, you don't have to answer now if you don't want to, but information, because some of what we've been addressing is federal fund requests, and it'd be interesting to know what that's coming up against.
Chair Reed, Chair Benz, Representative Smith, I'll provide you with more info. The transit agencies can probably help. My limited understanding is that the federal funds usually aren't available for operating expenses. They're available mostly for capital expenses to upgrade equipment, buy new equipment, et cetera. But it's really those operating costs that are really the challenge. And it's transit agencies large and it's transit agencies small. And it's not just in Oregon. It's around the country. And so whether we need to do a better job of trying to convince Congress to be more flexible with those federal funds is.
Thank you. Representative Beyer?
And quickly, I just want to confirm you're correct about the federal funds. There really isn't much in the way of operation dollars from the federal government. And part of the problem we have is even coming up with the state match to get some of those federal funds for our district. So it is a big challenge, and one I've been working on a long time, and would like to challenge the committee and the rest of the body to help us come up with a solution to provide this service that the federal government has so kindly given us. Very much needed service, as we can hear, but one that comes without revenue, and we could use some help.
Thank you, Representative Beyer. I was going to say at the beginning of your statement that it was an unfortunate way to end our hearing, but you gave us a nice challenge and some good words to take as inspiration. Thank you all who've been here as part of Transit Day. It's, I think, especially helpful as we transition towards the end of our consideration of House bills to have a reminder of how important transit is to people throughout Oregon. We appreciate you being here and helping us understand that. So with that, we'll close the informational meeting on transit, and I'm going to be jumping around the agenda a little bit. Representative Hicks, you're here now, so we want to open up public hearing on House Bill 2202 is the one you're here on. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so open public hearing there. We'll take your testimony after a brief summary from Zach, and then we're going to close 2202 to get back to our agenda, and we'll come back to 2202 a little bit later. So, Zach, can you give us a quick summary, please?
House Bill 2202 requires the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to conduct a study of geological opportunities in Oregon and present a report to the Legislative Assembly February 1st, and we do have amendments, so that changes to each odd number year.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your patience, Representative Hicks. We're glad you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you for extending me the courtesy of hearing the bill out of order. Members of the committee, there is and has been a...
And, of course, we need you to start with your name, please.
Indeed. I am Representative Wally Hicks. I represent most of Josephine County.
Thank you.
There is and has been a great and growing discussion about natural resources in Oregon on the whole, and particularly there's a lot of talk about timber. The Whopper, for example, is on people's minds, timber vis-a-vis perhaps the Japanese need to rebuild. And one part of the natural resources discussion that gets, in my opinion, far less attention than it probably should is the subject morals. Anyone who's been to Josephine County, Southern Oregon, has been able to look out over our vast and beautiful scenery and has seen, indeed, the trees. Our property or territory is carpeted with them, literally. But if you look a little lower and look at what's underneath those trees, there's mountains. And what's in those mountains? This isn't entirely an unasked or unanswered question. The Josephine County Natural Resources Plan, for which I'm going to quote in part and paraphrase in part here next, was presented to the Josephine County Board of Commissioners in regards to opportunities for extracting and utilizing our natural mineral resources for the betterment of our local and indeed statewide economy. When my grandmother was born in Grants Pass in 1920, reportedly there were 120 separate mines in what is now the city limits of Grants Pass, what have grown to be the city limits. Gold was very popular, of course, and it still is. There's reportedly about 500 miners in and around Josephine County, California as well, people who actually do make their living mining on some scale or another. Even the mines that have in the past been considered exhausted now, I am told, are becoming available again due to the evolution of technology. Geology dwells upon the old and the aged, and so a view back into history to find out where we have been on this subject and where we are going is appropriate. The economy of Josephine County in the 19th century can be seen as a three-legged stool consisting of mining, timber, and farming. It was a shaky stool with both mining and timber subject to the ups and downs of supply and demand, and farming has always been a marginal endeavor. The utilization of natural resources has in the past led to serious contention in the society of Southern Oregon. In 1941, a dispute arose in the state legislature as to whether to invest in the further development of a huge copper mine in the Illinois Valley, which is in my district, or whether to spend the money developing recreation sites. When the state opted for the campgrounds, the people of Southern Oregon and Northern California promptly proclaimed the creation of a new state. This is kind of famous in the lore of Southern Oregon. They founded the state of Jefferson. The state only lasted a couple of days because the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and people abandoned Jefferson in the interest of defending the country. World War II did, however, lead to a resurgence of mining in the face of the wartime need for strategic minerals. This is important to think of, too, the strategic value of mineral resources then as now. As late as 1952, there were 5 chromite concentration mills operational in Josephine County. However, as the nation began to deindustrialize and the production of steel waned, the demand for both chrome and chromite abated, and mining once again slipped in large measure from the economic mix, even though the resource remains. The end of World War II led to the full implementation of the ONC plan, with which we are all familiar, and timber production was able to take up the slack. Remember the three-legged stool. Southern Oregon is highly mineralized, containing what is perhaps North America's greatest concentration of ultramafic soils, which are high in metals, such as nickel, iron, chrome, and other heavy metals. Copper, gold, silver, zinc, and cobalt are present. The area came into serious settlement with the discovery of gold in Josephine Creek in the Illinois Valley in 1851. Note such towns still in existence today. Gold Hill. How did he get that name, right? Although heavily mined over the years, there exist today copper deposits, which once fueled the Queen of Bronze mine, known in its day as the most productive copper mine in the United States, right here in Oregon. There are known world-class deposits of chrome and chromite, and there remain viable loads of gold, including hundreds of mines and prospects.
Representative Hicks, we appreciate the history lesson and the good survey. I don't know if you were about to finish, but I'm hoping that might be the case. Excellent. I've never chaired a more packed agenda, so I'm trying to keep things moving along. So
I am. I'm done. I greatly appreciate you hearing this bill. This is an important bill.
Thank you. Do you have any comments on, we have a fiscal associated with it, if I'm reading right, of flip to the right page here, $445,249. Do you have any thoughts on where those dollars might come from?
I would suggest that if we don't have the money, and this is not to propose another amendment necessarily, but if we don't have the money in this biennium, then we set out the due date a few more years and at least get the project started.
Thank you. Any quick questions for Representative Hicks? I don't see any. Thank you very much for being
Thank
here.
You, Mr.
Appreciate
Mr.
it. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2202, and we have another legislator who's joined us. So if my co-chair doesn't object, we'll hear from Representative Barnhart quickly on my agenda here. House Bill 3213, so we'll open a public hearing on that. Representative Barnhart, you may have heard me as you were sitting there saying I've never chaired a more packed agenda, so whatever brevity you can offer will be much appreciated.
Thank you.
A quick summary.
House Bill 3213 prohibits roads in certain areas from being used for transportation purposes related to mining or processing of rock, aggregates, or minerals during certain hours.
Representative Barnhart.
We brought down material for a while ago. Were those distributed?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Barnhart, House District 13. I'm going to tell a story. I will do it very quickly.
Thank you, sir.
The issue that prompted this bill came to my attention last year from the small community in Coburg Bottom Loop Road, which was finding that there were very large gravel trucks, rock trucks, driving through their neighborhood on a very narrow set of streets 24 hours a day, every few minutes, leading to serious disturbances in the neighborhood because of the noise. As they went to pursue to find out what was happening and what they could do about it, they discovered that there were a very large number of different, both state, local, and county agencies involved in the issue having to do with mining on the river near Green Island on the edge of my district, including the Lane County Air Pollution Authority, Department of Geology and Mineral Resources, and Mineral Industries, Department of Environmental Quality, Oregon Department of Transportation, which I assume is the reason why the bill came here, and Lane County Land Management, among others. They were never able to get anyone to actually address any of these bureaucratic organizations to actually address the issues that they were concerned about, and that led to this bill. And I would say that the major concern of the people who lived in that area had to do with the fact that they did not seem to have any way of addressing what was an egregious, serious interference with their quality of life and their ability to live in their homes during the time that these giant trucks were moving through their neighborhoods 24 hours a day, every few minutes, keeping people awake, preventing them from living in from the enjoyment of their properties. I've given you some photographs to show you the nature of this neighborhood a little bit. I wish I had some better pictures of the houses. They come down close to the road, and it is a serious problem. And you'll note a couple of pictures include pictures of me holding what amounted to an impromptu town hall meeting. I came out to see one person to talk about this problem, and they brought the neighbors together, and we met on the driveway. And, of course, as while we were meeting, several of these very large trucks went by. You can see one here. I'm not suggesting that the bill I've proposed is any kind of a final solution to this issue, but it seems to me that that when we are busy doing construction work, and I think this was an ODOT project out on the freeway that led to this mining, that when we're doing construction work, we can do a better job of accommodating the neighbors of these mines, and at minimum, do a better job to allow them to at least get a few hours of sleep at night without these large trucks keeping them awake. Changing the way the things are scheduled, changing the way in which the material is handled, the way in which it is moved to the job site, and all of those kinds of things could be done that would accommodate these kinds of problems. And then I've included also the testimony of John Tyler, who is actually talking about a different mining site, also in my district, involving the Parvin Butte Quarry. The only comment that actually applies to this particular bill are the last couple of sentences. But I would encourage you to read the entire piece when you get a chance to do that, because he goes through the process of, he went through the process of actually investigating all of the permitting process that was involved in allowing this quarry to be reopened. And it is not good reading in the sense that he raised a number of serious concerns with the application itself, with the responsiveness of the agencies that were involved, and other things of that sort. In addition to all of the things that are in here, one of the issues that was of concern to the my constituents and others in the Dexter area had to do with the timing and the utilization of the public roadways for transportation of these materials at night. When these permits were initially allowed, over 50 years ago, there were very few people living in any of these areas. He describes, I think, in graphic detail, Mr. Tyler does, how many people were living in the area, in the Dexter area around this quarry, at the time that the permit was issued in 1954 to start it. But the issues that I'm raising and the issues that he raises in his testimony were not even considered by anyone in connection with the reopening of this permit. So I would urge the committee to seriously consider this bill that would at least allow the people living in their homes a time to sleep at night without having to listen to the sound of these large vehicles moving by on what they consider to be their residential street. I want to propose, and I'll tell you after reading, I wish I'd had Mr. Tyler's letter a year ago, because if I'd had it, I would have been proposing some very different bills to require state agencies to do a much better job of coordinating with each other on these kinds of matters. I'm not at all pleased with the fact that my constituents have, in my view, been significantly mistreated in the way that they have been. Thank you. That's all I have. And I'm prepared to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Are there any questions for him? Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, my question is, a lot of the activity when we're doing roads, just so we don't end up with traffic jams and everything, occurs at night?
Yes.
Would you say it would be better to do it in the day and inconvenience many rather than the few?
No, I wouldn't say that. To get to the point you're making, I think, with decent planning, the movement of rock could be done during the daytime in most situations, so they wouldn't have to be moved through the residential neighborhood at night. Even when the utilization of the material was going to be done at night, at a time when they can close a freeway lane.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up? Very quickly, yeah. Please.
I think this is something that we need to look at really closely, because I think a lot of it's asphalt that it has to come out of the plant hot. So, and it would be tough to move it and leave it lay and try to lay it after it's gotten cold.
Maybe the materials we're talking about, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, are river rock. Maybe they use it to make asphalt, but the material is river rock that we're talking about moving. Or in the case of the other quarry, we're talking about quarry rock taken out of the side of a hill.
Thanks for bringing the bill to us. We appreciate your description. And Representative Sheehan, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this has been going, the mining permit was a few decades old, is that correct?
50 years, yes. 50.
And but this trucking has just started recently, is that?
Yes, they reopened, yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan, they reopened the both of these mines to deal, what I believe, to deal with recent construction on the freeway. They're both relatively close to the freeway.
Very quick follow-up, please. Were at any time this, over the last 50 years, was this an active mining operation, or were they actively moving trucks at any other time over the last 50 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan, my understanding from the people on the Coburg Bottom Loop Road, many of them had lived there for nearly that long, and this is the first time that they had experienced anything even remotely like this. I'm not saying that there weren't some trucks moving occasionally, but I believe that these mines have been closed for a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mr.
And
Chair.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3213. And we'll get the work session on House Bill 2004 open. We can take care of that very quickly. Representative Bentz.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purposes of moving House Bill 2004 to the Veterans Committee.
Thank you. Representative Bentz has moved to suspend the rules for the purposes of moving House Bill 2004 to the Veterans Committee. Is there any discussion? Representative
At the risk of making somebody mad, this is a license plate bill, and I think it should be here or in the Transportation Committee. But given that, if it is the chair's pleasure to do that, I will keep keep my opinion to myself after having stated it.
Isn't it too late for that? Madam Vice Chair, appreciate the comment. I think the question is one that we would like the Veterans Committee to weigh in on. I am well aware of your opinions on license plates, and with one exception, I think I share them. So appreciate your comment. Any other discussion? Any objection? Don't see any. Was that an objection, Representative Smith?
I object.
Okay. Given that, we can stand at ease for a moment, please. Representative Benz. Thank you. Representative Benz withdraws his motion to suspend the rules, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2004. We'll move now to continuing public hearing on House Bill 2327 and finish up with the folks who had signed up to testify during our initial hearing on Monday. So, as before, I'll call up in panels that don't represent anything other than the order in which you have signed up, and 2 minutes apiece. You'll remember House Bill 2327 had to do with utilities and fees. So, Ralph Groner, Danelle Romaine, Sean Miller, please. And on deck will be Mark Landauer, Mike Dewey, and Jim McCauley. Missed Ralph. So given that, Mark Landauer, are you here? Come on up. Whoever would like to start, I'll start the clock when you do.
Okay, co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danelle Romaine. I'm here today representing the Oregon PUD Association. I have a couple of comments. We are opposed to House Bill 2327. Our PUDs pay over $7.5 million to local governments. We're centrally assessed for our property taxes, which means that we are paying not just on our office building, but on all of our poles, our plants, our materials and supplies, substations and sub-equipment. So all of that is considered in our property taxes. Many of the counties and cities we work with don't even require us to get a permit for this work because we have such a good working relationship with them. We leave the work in the right-of-way. We leave the roads better than when we found them. We've never had a complaint about our work in the right-of-way. And this is just another fee that would get passed down to our customers. We're not-for-profit entities, and our customers are already struggling to pay their electric bills, so we urge your no vote on this bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Romaine. Mr. Miller.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of Pacific Corp, an electric utility that operates in Oregon as Pacific Power. We're also concerned with House Bill 2327 as drafted. And Pacific Corp does business in Oregon in 31 of the 36 counties. And our concerns with the bill range from not understanding the and not including in the language limitations with the amount of inspection fees, how often they may take, what are the expenses associated with the actual fees itself. And it's something that we've met with the Associated Board of Counties twice, once late last year and once about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, asking for an understanding and a breakdown of the expenses that would be associated with this fee. And we have not to date received that, and we don't understand the wide range of expenses from $50 to one county to $500 to another county. And so without that standardization and without an understanding of those specific costs, we have concerns with the bill. We think those are important elements that would need to be in this bill for it to move forward. And so with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, I'll just leave it at that and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from Mr. Landauer first.
Good afternoon. Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association of Oregon, representing approximately 900 special districts across the state of Oregon. SDO does oppose House Bill 2327. There are several reasons for that, some that have already been articulated. I'll be very brief. First of all, the current system is working. There is no common methodology used by all 36 counties that we have been able to ascertain at this point. As Mr. Miller suggested, the fees are pretty spread across a large area. In most instances, our crews, who are very professional, leave the right-of-way in better shape than they've found it. The bill does not provide any guarantee that an inspection will, in fact, be conducted. We're concerned that in some cases, we're worried, frankly, that in some cases permits will be required to fix emergency-type situations, water main breaks, so on and so forth. It's not clear that there is an exemption for emergency purposes. And finally, there is work that can be done that, frankly, doesn't need a permit. A simple valve box change in the right-of-way involves a 12-inch by 18-inch cut. That's it. Our crews, frankly, do a fine job, get in and out very quickly, and as I said, the patch lasts for quite some time. So the bill is overly broad, and we would oppose the bill until greater certainty and definition is provided under the measure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just one quick question to which a yes or no answer would be fine for me. I heard you and others in various forms talk about a need for certainty and a lack of consistency and clarity across different ones. If the bill had something about a maximum or more clarity on methodologies, would that change your opinion about the bill? Without asking for an irrevocable commitment, recognizing that it might change based on the nature of that.
Mr. Co-Chair, we have, and I'll, Sean Miller again speaking on behalf of Pacific Corps, we have always said that we're interested in having that conversation. So we haven't got to that level because we haven't understood what that would mean, but that is what we've asked for, and we are more than willing to have that conversation and that certainty.
Thank you very much. Representative Beyer?
Thank you. And I don't know if it's the room or maybe I'm just contrary today. I don't know. But this is an issue that has come back and back and back over the years. And I don't know if there's a way to get everybody together on it, and I'm not quite sure what you're going to do with it. But I just want to put something on the table and remind people that what we're talking about here is not the utilities money and it's not the county's money. It's the taxpayers and the ratepayers' money. So one way or another, we as ratepayer and taxpayers are paying for this. I want to make sure that we're getting what we pay for. We're not duplicating any services. And if there's a way to work this out, fine. But just be aware that that's what we're talking about.
Thank you, Representative Beyer. We have just a couple more people to testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here. Mike Dewey, second call for Ralph Groner. Not here. And Jim McCauley, please. I'll start the clock when you start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. You have a letter that's being passed out from the Oregon Joint Use Association, their opposition to the bill. This is a very unique organization. It is made up of companies and the individuals that work in the right-of-way, the supervisors, and local governments. And you'll note that there are some cities on there that evidently are opposed to this bill based on the board of directors. So I pay your attention to that as you see that. We're a little bit unique. The cable companies under the Federal Cable Act, the cities and here the counties can charge franchise fees. And you did hear previously that this is not a franchise fee bill. I agree. But again, there are a number of counties that provide, if you're going to do business in that county, you have to have a franchise. And it's usually 5% of gross revenues. And that money goes to, in part, regulate the company and regulate the use of the right-of-way. So we're unique in the sense that we are already paying for the use of the right-of-way. I've not proffered up an amendment to provide an offset because I wasn't sure where this was going and talking to legislative council. Right now they are extremely busy and I didn't want to burden them with an additional request at this point in time. But if this bill were to move, I will offer that up and hopefully that would be considered. There was a discussion about property taxes. For some of you that are have been involved in the Revenue Committee, cable companies are now centrally assessed. Now, this is a battle we have in the Oregon Tax Court, and oral arguments will occur on the Comcast case. But our property taxes in the city, in the cities and counties, have gone up tremendously.
And that's
so,
2 minutes, Mr. Dewey.
I have no problem with that. I think I made my points. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dewey. Mr. Groner, you had your we called you three times. The challenge now is in your 2 minutes.
I apologize very much. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman.
He's going
to waive his time to me, by the way.
Thank you. Members of the committee, for the record, Ralph Groner representing AskMe. I've just finished testifying on the kicker, which is a counter for our union, so I had to be there. Thank you. 2327 is quite simply, I will say this on behalf of my counties, which are the majority of the counties. AskMe represents the employees. Quite frankly, I've worked on their problems for, 35 years, and about 4 years ago we said we'd fix the county problems somewhat. You have counties going under right now in this state. Timber tax is gone. The fact is that our Measure 5 and 50, Measure 50 is absolutely derailing local government as well as hurting your budget. And the fact of the matter is counties are desperate for any little help they can get. That forced me to testify for cigarettes for counties. State of Washington funds counties with a gross receipts tax totally dedicated to county government. In the end, then, when we ask...
1 minute left, Mr. Groner.
Okay, we ask for just a little bit to pay for the repair of our roads once those utilities who we all love and use and watch or heat with. The fact of the matter is we're asking for a very small amount to help counties that can no longer afford what I call a free lunch. We're not the cities who license these folks or take the big bucks, and I rep them also, so we want to thank them. But the fact is the counties truly are desperate, and they need any little bit of help they could get. And all we're asking is pay for what the actual cost of that repair is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garner. Mr. McCauley.
Members of the committee, Chair Reed, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. I just want to make a couple of quick comments. I think Representative Beyer, your thoughts earlier were right on point, because that's exactly what we find ourselves in at this point in time. This clearly is a fee-for-service. And right now, those fees are being supplied by other users of the right-of-way, not the folks who are cutting the surface, at least on county-owned lands. And that's why we're supportive of 2327. Chair Reed, I also think you have some good suggestions about if there's a way to get us closer to reach some additional support from some of the other folks around the table who are currently opposing this. I think we'd be willing to consider that as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have just a moment for question. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Groner, don't these utilities pay for the maintenance right now?
I couldn't hear you.
Don't these utilities pay for the maintenance right now?
My road fund, let's take for the maintenance, would come from my public works budget. For many, many years, our public works, I can speak for your county, Clackamas, not yours. My budget cost me 85 of my 140 road crew because we were 13 years without, we didn't have a gas tax increase for, was it 13 years? It may have been 14, without an increase. So we were falling further and behind. Secondly, in my county, we were losing our ONC funds were down, our federal timber receipts are down, and so forth. So don't we already cover it? We are not. We do not receive any remuneration, sir, right now whatsoever. The amount of money this cost us that could, my county, I ask, what would this bring in? Washington County was the same, $225,000. And my county director of our roads in Clackamas County said that's 2 miles of highways. That's what this means to us.
So is the answer no?
I thought I did a straight answer.
Okay.
There's no
Thank you.
Black
Thanks.
And white.
Representative Wagner.
Real quick, for Mr. Groner, did I hear you right that AskMe thinks that the county should be taking money from the franchise fees that the cities are getting? Because you said the cities are getting all the money, so if some of those franchise fees just went back to cover the expenses, that would probably take care of the problem, because they're not doing anything. Those franchise fees aren't being used for anything except for their general fund budget. Is that correct?
For your county general fund?
No, the cities are collecting the franchise fees from the pulses.
The city's fees go to the cities, not to the counties.
What I was getting at, follow-up, is should those fees for the poles and the utilities, should they be split up with the counties and the cities, split between the two, since they're both having to...
Thank you. I'm sorry. I don't mean to beat around the bush. That's not my style. I'll try. The fact is, we had a measure, Arch here, counties had a measure last session to come in and do a fee similar to the city's franchise, and legislators, rightfully or wrongfully, said not only no, but the way we talk in labor, hell no. So the fact is, we politically said, well, we've got to do something. We can't keep covering this cost. So we're in this session with a little bitty baby, and we're not trying to come under the door in your behind room. We're saying that the cost of that should be borne by the utility, not by the county, since it's out of their pocket, which takes money away from asphalt and road in your own neighborhood where you live, fixing those potholes.
Thanks. Representative Benz, did
you? Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I join Vice Chair Beyer in stating that this is a complex matter that didn't used to be complex, but as time has passed and more folks utilize those county right-of-ways and the number of wires and lines and pipes and other things that run through them becomes greater, if the county is charged with maintaining the rules and the catalog and the data bank that shows what's going on under those right-of-ways, there's a cost. And I think that cost breaks down into many different complex levels. And there's also a confusing challenge when it comes to separating the property tax issue from what should be paid for the additional cost the county undertakes by virtue of that road situation. To me, this deserves attention and is the kind of thing that doesn't lend itself to a civil fix. That's why the simple approach won't work here. It's a complex matter. And to me, it doesn't mean because it's complex we should ignore it. And I would recommend a work group or something between the folks that are involved because it needs attention. And I speak looking back at my county, Malheur County, where more and more and more things are going on within that right-of-way. Someone's riding herd on that, and I think there's a liability aspect that goes to the county that needs to be appropriately sorted out also. So that's my thinking on it. Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I got a no answer. I'd like to hear from utilities, or maybe Mr. Cleave could answer my same question. Doesn't the utilities already pay for?
Let's make it very quickly. I appreciated the summary that Representative Bentz offered, and I'd like to probably leave it there pretty quickly. Mr. Miller.
Very brief, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee. Sean Miller on behalf of Pacific Corn. If I understand the question correctly, and I want to just correct the record, if I may, the question was, do we pay for the maintenance after we're involved in the right-of-way? And the answer is absolutely yes. If there's something in that road, I think what we're talking about today is, and I understand the counties, and I understand the counties need to want to reimburse for the cost of the permit to inspect that work, but the actual cost involved after we're in the right-of-way and doing that work is all borne by the utility. And as you heard from other utilities, we often leave that right-of-way better than it was when we started the work. And so if that was the question on the cost involved, and what I thought I heard was that the county may come out and actually do work or maintenance or road work or something of that matter in the right-of-way after we're done, and we bear that cost. And so I want to distinguish between some of the costs that we're maybe discussing on standardizing the inspection process, and we understand that, and we're more than willing to try to work on that, but the actual costs themselves are borne by us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That completes the list of people who had signed up to testify on House Bill 2327 when we first heard it. I appreciated the particularly the summary that you offered, Representative Benson. Join you in suggesting that this is an issue that we'd like to have some momentum on and see again as soon as possible. That closed the public hearing on House Bill 2327 and open public hearing on House Bill 2201. Zach, do you want to give us a summary? And Representative Benz is making his way around, and obviously Representative Benz, bring anyone else you would like with you.
House Bill 2201 requires any bill introduced before the Legislative Assembly to be accompanied by an environmental, or excuse me, that is relating to environmental matters, to have an economic impact analysis performed.
Thank you. Co-Chair Benz.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Cliff Benz, State Representative of District 60. I bring to you today House Bill 2201. The concept underlying this bill was the surprise I enjoyed 2 years ago, and actually 3 years ago, when I saw bills coming to the floor that received a lot of discussion and also in committee, but many times no indication of what the cost was going to be of the implementation of the bill. So this bill, although it's listed as being one that's triggered by an environmental bill, in fact, under the dash ones, the bill is actually addressed to any measure. And the concept is that if a certain number, two-fifths of the legislature, thinks that a measure that comes out of a committee should be reviewed for purposes of cost of compliance or costs or impact upon the economy, then indeed the matter would be referred to either rules or to, in our case, to this committee for the purpose of trying to figure out what the cost of implementation, what the cost of compliance, what the cost upon the economy might be. And fortunately, I was assisted in this crafting of this bill. In fact, I think I'm overstating my involvement by Mr. Chandler and my legislative director, Joy Camp, as they put together what you're looking at today. I think that it's possible that if the House and Senate wanted to do this by rule, they could do so at the very beginning. We wouldn't need this bill. That hasn't happened, so that's why I brought the bill. And the best person to address the technical aspects of it is Mr. Chandler. And with that, members of the committee, I'll leave it to him to answer any of your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chandler. If you want to get started, and just before you do, I'll call up a couple of other people who are in the audience so we can save time. Mazin, you're signed up. Would you like to come forward? And I also see Sue Marshall on the list. Is she here? Don't see her. How about Ann? Oh, there she's sneaking behind Mazin. Yeah. Sorry. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. Very much appreciate Representative Bence's work on this bill. We actually put in a bill, House Bill 2610, which is also referred to your committee, and we are working on 22201 in lieu, but it's the same concept. And the idea actually came up, as with Representative Bence, with an unpleasant experience some sessions, many sessions back, over in my experience, where during the legislative process, spending bills go down to Ways and Means. If you're going to spend the state's money, the bills go to Ways and Means, and then at least in theory, some sort of triage takes place there where the bills are evaluated, not just the budgets, but bills that would have state spending and say, is this worth more than that one? Which one should we invest the state's resources in? There is no such process for bills that create job losses that hurt the economy, or for that matter, that help the economy. Bills come through substantive committees, there's discussion, but then each one is voted on the floor, separate as and apart from any other bill, and there isn't any way to evaluate legislative piece 1 against legislative piece 2 or 3 or 12 or 19. And as a longtime lobbyist, I can tell you that every session, even the session that where nothing particularly bad happens from a business standpoint, at the end of the session, one can look at this bill did this fee or this imposition or this one had this process or so on and so on. And at the end of it, we've created a number of cuts which are just as damaging as one big wound. That's the point of this, is to simply not say these bills should or shouldn't move forward, but that they should at least be evaluated in context of the rest of the legislative packages that are being considered and in context of what the individual pieces might cost in terms of implementation for agencies, which is addressed in part in Ways and Means, but not entirely, what it will cost to the people who are subject to the regulation or the government entities that are subject to the regulation in terms of compliance downstream, and what overall the piece of legislation might do with regard to the state's economy and economic development. The intention, and the dash one speak to this, is not to flag every single bill, but to have a process by which the body can identify those which are going to cause problems potentially, bring them to this committee, to another committee, to have that sort of thoughtful review done.
So, thank you. Let me ask you a couple questions. Can you say something about why, and perhaps this is to you, Representative Bence, too, what the thinking was about when that determination is made? And it's interesting that it's made by two-fifths after a committee has reported it, or should that happen at the beginning? At the present time, of course, we have some revenue-raising bills are flagged before they go any further. How could you speak to that?
Mr. Co-Chair, I think as much as anything else, well, I'll defer to Representative Bence if he had a different take on it. From my perspective, that's as much that's a placeholder concept, two-fifths of the placeholder concept, having either the leadership do it. There are a variety of ways you could flag these and a variety of times during the process. If I could have figured out how to do it, I would have had basically a parallel process to the Ways and Means process where bills went and got evaluated again in context of the overall legislative agenda for that session, and that would have been horribly cumbersome. Mm-hmm. And I would have probably not only yelled at myself, but got shot by the lobby. So that was unworkable. I think in terms of, assuming you want to move this bill forward, but I strongly encourage you to work it, those sorts of moving parts are ones that we could certainly talk about. I think there's, as Representative Bence indicated, this may be possible under House rules. I wouldn't want to take a quiz on the House rules. But if so, we could borrow from that process and may perhaps and use that as a model for something legislatively. Another moving part I should mention, which is why Mazin is up here, is that the Dash 1's call for LFO to do this, that may mean the analysis should be done by somebody other than the legislative, other new folks, because you don't have time. One possibility might be to have LRO do it, and I'll let Mazen speak to that possibility as well.
That's a nice segue. The other, just one last question for you, either of you. Is it your thought that it would go, I think I understood this, but maybe not in what you said, that it could go to a sort of relevant policy committee if it's flagged as potentially economically significant? It would go, or is it your intention to have a committee that does this?
Mr. Chair, members, my thought would be this committee.
Okay.
Because
as the economic development,
the appropriate
committee?
Yes, whatever. Okay. Obviously, committee names aren't set in granite.
Understood.
But whatever bill that committee had responsibility for, bills dealing with the economy, job creation, what have you,
understood,
would be the one most best equipped.
Thank you, Mazen. It's nice to see you outside of the revenue committee.
Well, thank you, Chair Reed and Chair Burns. It's good to see you and down in this format and all of you. Mazen Malik with the State Revenue Office, and this bill, of course, caught our eyes because it talks about economic impacts, and kind of being the economists around the building, we like to do economic impacts. However, it also caught our eyes that it's legislative fiscal office with a lot more accounting types and budgets than economists. So, you know, believing that economists could leap off tall buildings and do all kinds of great things, we think that, the concept in general is probably a valid concept. Some narrowing of what we expect and our expectations, and some of the things that you see in the bill might have a little more ambitious parts to it, just because things are probably not as well defined in that context as small geographical areas. Some places here, I think, in the second page talks about the number of jobs in geographic in a certain geographic area. That might or might not be possible, depending on what kind of focus, what kind of project. Everything has to have its parameters, if you will, from inputs and outputs and that kind of stuff. So those things, I think, could be done. These are important information to have. However, I think we should approach these ideas with the thought that it might not be as full inclusive in its outcome as all these stipulated outcomes could be, which means that we might end up sometimes with a lot more words than numbers. However, we think if there is anywhere that this could possibly be done and done well, it probably should reside in somewhere where people kind of like playing these games.
I appreciate that summary, and it sounds very much like the conversations we have in hearing room A, doesn't it? Thank you very much. Mrs. Marshall, please.
Yes, thank you. Co-Chair Reed and Benz, members of the committee, my name's Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Tualatin Riverkeepers and the Willamette Riverkeeper. We're opposed to the bill. I have read through the Dash 1. It seems to be moving in at least a narrower direction and doesn't call out environmental matters specifically.
Or a more broad direction.
Or yes, right, in that it doesn't call out environmental matters specifically. How many bills it would apply to would be narrowed, and I think that probably is a good direction. The primary concern, though, that I wanted to share with you related to economic analysis and how they're applied historically and generally, it has excluded public trust resources and the environment in general. Those costs are borne by the public and therefore not really part of an economic analysis. We think that needs to be folded into any kind of analysis. I know this committee is looking at some other bills related to variances and whether or not some of these legacy pollutants that the public is having and industry is having to deal with, were even able to meet state water quality standards. That's a very high price to pay, but some of those things may not sort out in an economic analysis. So we would just advise caution in how that's applied and that we look to this body to protect public trust resources and hope you'll consider those. Thank you.
Ms. Marshall. Representative Winder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably for revenue, but I actually like this bill. because it's information that makes it nice for us to have. You think it'd be a little more palatable if we limited it to, like, 5 bills per session or 10 bills? That way you don't get flooded with everybody trying to play political games, that it has to come from leadership or, well, we have 2/3, but there has to be a majority of the vote for it to go to you, the way it's set up now. But then we put a cap on the number of bills that we did, because to me this is a very valuable tool and could be a very meaningful piece of legislation that we pass out of this body if we go ahead with it. So I'm just trying to think of cost, and so you don't get overran in your department.
Co-Chair Reed and President Biden, I think both offices who looked at this bill, both legislative and revenue, we think that this is probably work to keep at least half to three-quarter FTE occupied. I mean, there are certain enough work, and not only that, but you probably would have some level of model. You need a model to be specified for the state, and those models sometimes do take into account which jobs by industry, by type, by so on. And of course, you're going to have to keep feeding the model with data and stuff, and run those. So the more, the narrower the scope, as you suggested, probably the more relevant output that you would be able to get. More cohesive and coherent type of analysis that you would receive. You're right, a lot. If you end up with 100 or 200 bills that need economic impact, that you might see the same outcome more and more, because it's if 100 bills in the session impact the economy, then we're doing a lot more work than we should be doing, I guess, for the economy.
Representative Benson, and while you're preparing your question, Ann Hannis, you're on deck, so if you want to join us up at the front row, we'll have you ready to go. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just more of a remark in response to Sue's comment on the environmental issues. To me, the focus here wasn't so much on the balancing and weighing of the benefit of an environmental law, so much as it was a desire to call out the cost. I'm going to use an example, the biofuel law, as it applied now to Eastern Oregon. And what happened there, of course, is we now have a 5% biodiesel requirement. And that has had a significant impact on the cost of diesel. That would have been nice to know in advance of the vote on that bill. It would have been nice to know that the cost of diesel all around the state was going to go up. That's actually called out in this bill on line 27, where the folks would be asked to tell us what the impact on the cost of goods and services of the action would be in the state. And this kind of knowledge is relevant, and I guess I want to make this into a question. In the Clean Water Act situation, the agency itself is required, under one of the statutes I can't remember the number of, to give us an economic impact study of the Clean Water Act activities that they're doing. In fact, the study is about 233 pages long. I've read it, and it reaches no conclusion. And but there is no doubt that the previous legislatures knew that when agencies take action, they're supposed to tell us what the economic impact is going to be. So the question would be, why are we immune from that requirement? And there may be many good reasons. That's why I put ourselves in charge of making the call, and why we would ask Mazin or others to tell us their best guess of how much diesel fuel prices are going to go up in the state should we do something. And that was what this bill is designed to do. And my question to you is that bad?
Co-Chair Reed and Bent, I don't think it's bad. I think it's useful information to have. I guess related to the fuel, it's kind of a cost-benefit analysis in addition to an economic analysis. If what is the value to changing the type of fuel? Are there air quality benefits as well that can be come into the equation? The same is true, I think, with water quality. I think there's legislation intended to correct problems. While there are some immediate economic impacts, there's also larger and broader air, water, land quality issues that are those public trust benefits that needs to be considered as well.
Thank you. And it's good to know what you do with your weekends now, reading this 240-page report. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is really just a comment. I like this idea Just a comment as well. We're here to exercise our judgment as well, and what I'm afraid of is that this might become a tool that allows our discretion just to be, we're waiting for some red light to warn us. But I hope that as committees, we're supposed to be vetting these processes. There's nothing that prohibits us to go to LRO or LFO to do this kind of as a vetting process through our committee, right?
Well, I would think the limit is probably the number of smart people there and the hours in the day, but in general,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, same thing with this as well, but I guess what I'm just trying to say is I hope this doesn't become a crutch to us to push off some of our heavy lifting that we need to do as a committee.
That's a good point.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond to that, because that's one thing I meant to mention in my testimony. The intention wouldn't be to provide a crutch, but to give this committee, for example, some better information about what was going on in the health care committee or in the agriculture committee or in another committee where you may or may not be sitting, and the only time you ever see the legislation that was under consideration is when it comes to the floor for a vote, and you, again, don't have that context of what those bills might do compared to the bills you looked at. And so the idea here would be to have that contextual look, not to say, as I said, the bill shouldn't go forward, but that in light of everything else that's happening, how valuable is it to have this particular regulation or this particular imposition, whatever it might be, versus all the others. That's the intention. Again, not to take the pressure off, but actually give you more data to make your decisions, both in floor votes and in committee work.
Understood. Thank you. I'm looking at the clock, so I got to keep moving here. Ann Hannes, you have just a couple of quick minutes, hopefully.
Hi. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ann Hannes. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and we have supported and continue to support the concept of providing economic impact statements on appropriate bills. We have provided a lot of information to the legislature in various forms, including fiscal impact statements in the past. I'm going to put my economist hat on and echo some of the things that Mazin said, in that economic analysis is a little bit different than fiscal analyses, in that they can be complex and time-consuming to prepare, depending on the nature of the bill that you're talking about. And so it's important to kind of have some expectations about what those economic analyses would actually be able to be included in it, particularly if you're working under a tight time frame, such as 5 days. Sometimes it's difficult to pull that kind of information together, especially if we're working with, for example, with AOC with 36 different counties. I'd suggest that if, you know, in trying to do something like this, that we work closely with LFO, LRO, and trying to decide how do you approach these types of analyses so that you don't have duplication. For example, the Employment Department has the information on personal income and employment data, and they might be better prepared to be able to do those type of job impact analysis or provide that information. The other thing to mention to you is that when looking at economic development has been interpreted or defined to be pretty broadly. So that may be something you want to look at, is the types of economic impacts that would be applied to what type of bills. And the same goes with rules, because that could be applied to a wide range of programs. So we'd be happy to work with you and with and the proponents on this further. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the good discussion, and Representative Benz, you've certainly opened a good topic here, so we'll keep it up. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2201, and stand by a moment. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2860. Give us a summary, Zach, and then Representative Nathanson, feel free to invite anyone up with you that you would like.
House Bill 2860 creates a Rail Advisory Council for the purpose of advising the Department of Transportation and the Oregon Department of, the Oregon Transportation Commission on matters related to the state rail system.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson and Mayor Piercy. We're glad to have you back in the building. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2860 is what I call Let's Get Serious About Rail Bill. The objective of this bill is to ramp up our discussion and our work around rail. We've been doing a pretty nice job, but we find ourselves way behind other states, and this doesn't bode well for Oregon's being positioned well for economic recovery. We need to elevate the coordination and planning for improvements from an administration-driven or department-driven effort to a major policy effort with legislative and public involvement to guide the process and continue it into the future. I believe that the Commission and the Department Director recognize that a lack of stable funding for rail is a top challenge. I don't disagree with that as a hurdle. However, a lack of a better effort can and will get in the way of discussions about funding. To make the case for Oregon dollars, we have to involve the public. Interest is high right now. It almost couldn't be higher on two fronts. The enthusiasm for passenger rail is extremely high, and there is a call to action for expanding jobs and state economic activity. We have to be ready to make the case for federal funding as it becomes available. At a meeting last summer of about 30 stakeholders, there was an underlying sentiment of not enough around rail improvements and not fast enough and an uncoordinated community of interest. There were a number of different disparate parties talking about passenger rail improvements. Freight had its separate advisory committee. And all of those have their purpose, but I'm saying we better ramp up a coordinated effort and get serious now. Several people have asked me, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why change the structure? Isn't everything fine? I would argue it's not fine when Oregon gets less than 0.1% of the federal money that went for rail improvements. Something isn't as going as well as it could be. This bill does a couple of things. It would be, the first of all, the idea is to replace the current department advisory group with a higher-level rail advisory council. That council would be proactive, planning for near and longer-term improvements. An additional specific task would be around passenger rail. And I'm blasting through some of this because we're going very fast. Rail topics are currently discussed by a 14-member advisory group appointed by the director of the Department of Transportation. This bill would morph that process into a higher-profile group, and if you consider an amendment that we've already had prepared, 14 members, same as now, a slightly different composition, but again, the same size, appointed by the governor, a much higher-level council then, an advisory to the Oregon Transportation Commission. This bill does not take away participation by anybody. It merely elevates the participation. Back in 1992, the Federal Rail Administration designated 466 miles between Eugene and Vancouver, B.C. as a high-speed rail corridor. Last spring, 25 states received grants through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. We weren't ready. We received about $8 million, and not even all of that was spent on what is strictly rail improvements. Compare that to Washington's $590 million. We need a higher profile discussion about improving freight as well as passenger rail. On the passenger side, as I mentioned, enthusiasm is extremely high as we look for opportunities to grow the economy by connecting knowledge-based industries and universities and add on to that the aging population, which you heard about earlier in today's testimony about transit. There's a natural push toward using trains for intercity travel. You've received written testimony from a number of advocates. Some of it focuses on passenger rail. And, of course, some of the improvements that would benefit passenger rail will also have an immediate beneficial effect on freight rail as it reduces congestion and frees up capacity and allows faster travel time. On the freight side, a lack of facilities to transload rail cars in Portland metro area, a constrained rail capacity, choke points, and inadequate freight infrastructure ought to worry us seriously. Oregon companies export to customers all over the U.S. and the world. Key products range from footwear, home furnishings, metal parts, and solar cells to bulk grain, wine, lumber, and nursery stock. Business is concerned, however, about the weakness of Oregon's multimodal transportation system. After studying articles in an AOI journal and several other resources, it appears that among problems companies cite that negatively affect their ability to move their products efficiently and cost-effectively, the following, quote, rail congestion and lack of capacity on main lines and short lines, end quote. Several companies were able to estimate the cost of bottlenecks and transportation problems, both direct and indirect, as they changed their scheduled production and rerouting trucks. One company noted $1,000 per rail car when a company has to shift from rail to truck when a rail line is shut down.
Representative Nathan, I wonder if you could just take us through the bill real quickly. There are a lot of people here to testify, I think probably people you know and perhaps invited. And yes. Though we're in a different room, there is still going to be another person walking through the room to take over the committee room, please.
Yes.
Thanks.
I hope you will encourage moving this bill forward so that it can be discussed even further if you'd like further discussion in another work session. The bill does several things. As I mentioned, it sets up a permanent rail advisory council that would be appointed by the governor. That's a higher level council than what exists right now as a department level committee. A second component is it asks to recommend, well, it overall would advise the commission and the department on current and future needs for freight and passenger rail. That's described in a section of the bill. It also has a second specific part to study the feasibility of establishing a bi-state rail authority. We know that there's interest by the current governor, there's interest by advocates all over the United States and in this state in higher speed rail. I have talked with colleagues in the state of Washington, in the House and Senate. There's great interest on that end, too. Oregon needs to be working with Washington in a bi-state capacity, and it would ask the group to study the feasibility of that as well. That's all I have for right now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Nathanson. Mayor Piercy.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Benson Reed and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kitty Piercy. I'm the mayor of the city of Eugene, and actually I'm a former state representative, so it's nice to be back in the room again. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2860, which, as Representative Nathanson has said, would establish a rail advisory council to advise the Oregon Department of Transportation on matters relating to state rail system. This is a critical time for rail, a moment of opportunity. And not only in Oregon, but across the nation. Just this morning, U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said, "Today we are another step closer to delivering an innovative national transportation network that brings new jobs, something we care deeply about in Oregon, and economic opportunity to the American people. Since I announced the availability of an additional $2.4 billion for high-speed rail projects, governors and members of Congress have been clamoring for the opportunity to participate. That's because they know that high-speed rail will deliver tens of thousands of jobs, spur economic development across our communities, and create additional options for our citizens as the country's population grows. So, the Northwest Corridor, as we just heard, was recently awarded some federal stimulus funds to make improvements on the rail line between Seattle and Portland. Unfortunately, as you just heard, we received only $8 million out of $598. We'd like to get more because Oregon didn't have the vision in place, and which is necessary to receive those federal funds. So we have a lot to do and a long way to go, and we can and must get there. And we can get there by making sure that we have the right people at the table to move this conversation forward. And this conversation is not only about moving people and freight. Implementation of a rail vision presents a number of other important opportunities. Aside from the transportation necessity of rail, an improved rail system will reduce our dependence on foreign oil, lower harmful carbon emissions, things that are the goals of this body, foster new economic development, and give Oregonians more choice when it comes to moving around the state and the country. All this is true for freight rail as well. It is clear that we must build a well-functioning rail system in the Northwest, and we must build it now for our folks and our economy. We must continue the conversation on passenger and freight rail and get people involved in a way that we really never have before. Oregon has been given a rare opportunity, and it is now to begin the transformation of our transportation system, and every Oregonian should get on board. We must, as a community, as a state, as a corridor, join together to share ideas and strengthen our combined efforts to make rail a reality in the Northwest Corridor. This is the time for rail, a moment of opportunity. A rail advisory council can help continue the conversation and would provide for improved coordination of freight and passenger rail and intermodal services and set up a process for developing strategies for developing rail services in the Northwest Corridor, which we believe are important critical steps to take. Look forward to you addressing this and us all working together at the local level, at the state level, in trying to move rail forward and provide job opportunities for the people of our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Any quick questions from the panel? Representative Byer.
Yes, thank you. Mayor Piercy, as a member that is sitting on, was appointed to chair at one of the committees that the OTC appointed to look at rail, is it the funding piece you're looking at? I'm not quite sure which of those two committees.
I've been asked to co-chair the committee that would look for the rail alignment between Portland and Eugene. Okay. So we have to have that before you have to know what you're paying for before you pay for it.
Follow up. Yeah, I'm looking for an idea of how you think these sync together. Are they doing in your mind? Is there more oomph behind this proposal than there is behind the proposals that are out there? Are they just two separate things?
I guess what I would say, Representative Beyer and members of the committee, chairs, is that this is something that I think you should take a really close look at and see if you think this is the direction to go. I think Representative Nathanson just wants to ask you to really consider having a committee that would lift this to a higher level. Whether this is the way we do it, or you come up with something different, or you make better what we've got, I think it just what she wants to do, and with your help, is to encourage that we elevate this discussion. And I think probably you all know that we aren't going to get anything unless we do elevate the discussion. So I know that you have a lot of knowledge about that. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Sheehan. Representative Lindsay, let's go with Sheehan first, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the current rail advisor, and whatever the name of the current one is, are they just doing a bad job? Do they? Yeah. Like, are they capable of getting this money that you want to create the new rail advisory thing to get?
Mr. Chair and members, the current structure has been reviewing, for example, lists of projects that would be available through special funding packages. You know, when you talk about Connect Oregon, for example, and there are some discrete rail projects in there. It's my contention that we have not had an elevated discussion because we have had basically a department-level advisory group rather than a governor's-appointed council. That we have higher-level committees to discuss many topics that are important to the state. Rail is so critical to our economic future that I think we need a higher-level discussion, a council-level. The current committee has been functioning. They meet, but I would say it's a little bit more in a reactive mode, reacting to topics brought by the department, rather than a full-on public discussion, grabbing the opportunities to move ahead more quickly and in a more statewide coordinated fashion. Basically, this is the time, this is a way to elevate and move the discussion.
Representative Lindsay.
Mr. Chair. This is a random statement. I don't know where else to state it, so I'll state it here. I love passenger rail. I lived in Europe for a couple of years. Get over there once or twice a year in Japan, and their rail for passenger does very well. Ours here could use a lot of help, and I hope we do it smartly. Mm-hmm. When it takes me an hour door-to-door to get from my house to downtown, and as opposed to when I can just drive in 30 minutes, mm-hmm. when it takes me 5 hours to go by rail to Seattle from Portland instead of driving in 2:45, we could do a lot better. So for whatever that's worth, I state it publicly that we could be a lot more smart at our passenger rail.
Thanks very much. So we have a number of people to hear from, and we'll try to get through as many as we can. Representative Smith?
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
You seem to always wait until I move on. Sorry about that.
Representative Nathanson? Sorry, quick question. Do you know of federal requests that we have made for rail dollars, and do you know if there are any such requests pending?
Yes, we have made requests. That's why we got
a little bit.
The $8 million that we got. We also passed on an opportunity to request money when other states were requesting additional funds because we weren't prepared. We just simply weren't. Mm-hmm. We've missed opportunities. And a major opportunity, and I want to make sure we don't do that. Continue to miss opportunities to ask for major money because we don't have our plans in place or our vision.
Thanks.
Thank you. Dave Rosenfeld, Floyd Smith, Patrick Capper.
Oh, yes.
So given the number of minutes remaining and the number of people, I'd like to ask if you could make your comments in a minute and a half. We do want to hear from the department today as well, so I apologize for the compression, but we'll try to get through that. So, Mr. Capper, do you want to start?
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Pence. My name is Patrick Capper with the Oregon Association of Nurseries, and my testimony is being distributed right now, so I will be brief. I just want to touch on a few points regarding 2860 that we are here in support of. The OAN represents more than 1,200 individual stock producers, retailers, landscapers, and related companies serving the nursery and greenhouse industry. Every day our members are forced to operate at a competitive disadvantage caused by the inability of our current transportation infrastructure to accommodate the freight and commodity traffic in our region generates. We recognize the objective of this bill is to ramp up the discussion and work on improving rail.
Our ability to successfully integrate rail into the available transportation mix for our state shippers depends on safe and functional rail lines, dependable schedules, and the availability of refrigerated rolling stock. Our future success depends on the resolution of long-term regional transportation problems and success in finding cost-effective ways to move Oregon nursery products across the country. We therefore urge your support of House Bill 2860. I appreciate your time this afternoon, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, please.
I'm Floyd Smith, Representative Reed, and members of the committee. I represent the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, which has done advocacy for freight and passenger rail for 35 years in the state. We support this bill advisedly. Three conditions we would like to see, and that is that it have a passenger focus, understanding that there is an Oregon Freight Advisory Committee, that it report to the commission, but that the department also be represented on the committee, and that the Bi-State Advisory Committee, if established, have part of its role to be a funding role to determine how funding is done for passenger rail particularly. And as Representative Nathanson and Mayor Piercy have indicated, this would help to offset some of the funding disparities that has occurred with the stimulus money, we believe. With me is Donald Leap, who is the president of our association. He's seated behind me, so if you have questions, he's far better able than I to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Rosenfeld.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld, Osberg's executive director. Osberg is a statewide consumer group. We support House Bill 2860. Our perspective on passenger rail is Oregon faces an enormous amount of challenges in the coming decades, namely rising gas prices, traffic and congestion, and then overdependence on foreign oil. Passenger and freight rail are one important strategy towards getting ourselves out of those challenges, not the only strategy, but one important one. Oregon has, in the last year and a half, made some very important strides towards getting there. We're supportive of the efforts that ODOT Rail Division has been doing to obtain some of the federal funds so we can start doing the studies needed to get ourselves on the right path. I myself have the privilege of serving on the Rail Funding Task Force, which will be chaired by Bill Wyatt of the Port of Portland, and that will be hopefully coming back to you all with a recommendation in a couple of months on some of the best financing mechanisms moving forward, including both public and private partnerships. In addition, this bill is an important way to permanently institutionalize the citizen oversight that we're going to need as more funding is going to be coming in, and we're going to have to figure out how to best spend it so we can make the right investments. And right now we haven't had that permanent infrastructure in place. This would do it. It's a great step forward, and we support it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions for this panel? I don't see any. Thank you very much. So we have Alex Kyler and Kelly Taylor, please. We'll see if we can make it through before, I guess it would be Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Olson walking through the door. Mr. Kyler, go ahead.
Thank you. Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. You have our testimony in front of you. We are in support. The Lane County Board of Commissioners is in support of House Bill 2860. You've seen previous bills in this committee actually about freight issues that we've dealt with in Lane County with regards to the opening and the challenges in transferring ownership of the Coos Bay Rail Link. We have encountered a number of barriers, we believe, with regards to expansion of freight rail in Lane County, and they're unfortunate barriers because there's huge economic development potential through rail opportunities that we've just been unable to take advantage of. We feel like this new council would breathe fresh life into the discussion, and we certainly note in the county the important role that the City of Eugene and specifically Mayor Piercy have taken with regards to the discussion about improved passenger rail in Oregon. I will close. If you don't throw me out of here, I think Gert Schlack will probably take me out later. But Lane County has noted that we believe that the Association of Oregon Counties could play a greater role in the discussion around freight rail, and Lane County will endeavor to try to bring that conversation along within that association.
Thank you, Mr. Kyler. Ms. Taylor, the next committee is starting to circle, so please go ahead.
No problem. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. I'm the Rail Division Administrator. I just, real quick, background, the current Rail Advisory Committee actually was part of a bill we had asked to be introduced back in 05. And this committee, House Transportation at that time, heard it. A lot of advisory committees around, some by bill, statute, some by commissions. This committee said, love the concept, have your commission form it. We did. The committee has served very well for the state of Oregon. The biggest things that have been on the plate to deal with in the last several years has been Connect 1, Connect 2, and Connect 3. And rail has done very well with all three of those. In fact, rail has received about half of the $300 million to date. And the stimulus funds, again, were another big part. There's a fundamental difference between Washington and Oregon in passenger rail. And we've been talking about that for several years. And I've characterized it as a fire hose and a garden hose hooked up to each other. And the difference is in Washington, they for years, on their own dime, not waiting around for the feds or anything, on their own dime, have raised and have revenue mechanisms that raise several hundred million dollars and have been working for years at chipping away at projects, et cetera, and plans to get themselves going. We, on the other hand, have not had the luxury of that. We don't have the staff that they do. We don't have the funds that they do. Oregon's just in a different economic spot than they are. And so when the federal program came along, out of the blue, unbeknownst to anyone it was going to happen, and said, here's $8 billion, and here are the requirements, very few states actually could meet it. Now, I know people say, well, Washington got $590 million, and Oregon got $590 million, and Oregon got $8 million, and that's true. We applied for $2 billion just like they did. The way that the FRA sees it is it's a corridor. The corridor runs between Eugene and Vancouver, B.C. So as far as the FRA is concerned, Federal Railroad, the corridor received $600 million. To us, it doesn't feel that way, but that is the way it's viewed nationally. Now, they have shown us that what we need to do under the new guidelines, if we want to get to those construction dollars, and we have applied in every one of the rounds. We did not sit back on any of the rounds. We've applied. We've just recently applied again. Florida is giving up their money. They have almost $2 billion, and they're giving it up. They're turning it back. They're not going to use it. So FRA has opened up applications. We've applied. What we're eligible for, because we've not had funding to do studies, to do plans, to do, and there's some new requirements that came out of the blue that most people had not done, we applied in the last round for money to do the 25-year Oregon Rail Plan that has new federal requirements in it. We were granted that money. We will be doing it. It was going to be the Rail Advisory Committee that led that plan because that would be one of the things that they do. They do beyond Connect Oregon. And we got money to do the Tier 1 Environmental Impact Statement, which is more than a route analysis. This bill is talking about that the Rail Advisory Council would do frequency and routes and speed of trains and by state authority and everything. That actually gets done. It's going to be done and is underway when we get the funds because they've been granted as part of that Tier 1 environmental statement and part of the service development plan. It's federally mandated, and there's a process that drives it. So it will be a very large stakeholder-driven process that encompasses the whole corridor between Eugene and Portland. And so I just want you to know that the things that are in the bill are underway. And with that, it isn't a matter of whether it's statute or department. It's really a matter of funding. That's really the bottom line. And I know Director Garrett has mentioned that to you before in the past. We've testified on the fact that rail funding in Oregon is pretty scarce.
Thank you very much.
With that, I end.
Any quick questions, recognizing that Representative Edson?
I don't have a question, Mr. Chair. Before we adjourn, I just wanted to make sure the committee understands that in your packet you have letters from Florigenix, Lane Transit District, American Public Transportation Association, Oregon Health and Science University, OSU, and others. I think it's important to note that things may have been perking along at sort of this level, but the existence of such enthusiasm by some regular folks out there who've been participating in this for ramping up the discussion shows that there's some pent-up desire for doing something with greater greater authority and greater effort. Thus, we have letters coming in from all over the place saying, explaining that they think there's a value to doing something different.
Pointing it out. I appreciate you bringing the bill, and I'm sure we will continue the discussion. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2860, and we'll be carrying over House Bill 2370 to our next meeting. Is that sufficient notice, Zach? Okay. If there's not anything else to come before the committee, we will
carry 2202 over.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Benz reminds me to carry over House Bill 2202 as well. Appreciate that. And we'll close the committee for today. Thank you.